do you talk to your client about this? Like, I am getting phone calls from reporters before I'm getting phone calls from the CID, before I'm getting phone calls from the base. It's really disheartening. It just really makes you think, does anyone give a damn? What is going on in our society? How is this happening?
Natalie Cuomo, I want to thank you for being with us. The attorney for the family of Vanessa Guillen, the missing Fort Hood soldier whose remains, they believe, have been found in a shallow grave near the Army installation in Texas. That does it for our show. I thank you so much for joining us. Have a safe holiday. Tomorrow, a Democracy Now! Special with Cornel West and Angela Davis. Remember, stay safe and wear that mask. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
James Chassie, a gentle soul who lived with schizophrenia, was well known in Portland as a writer, artist, and musician. In 2006, James was brutally killed by Portland police. He committed no crime, yet he was tackled, beat, kicked, and tased. He later died in police custody. The police officers who killed James Chassie were never held accountable. Join us on Prison Pipeline, July 6th at 6:30 p.m. as we remember James Chassie.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a dramatic surge in new COVID-19 cases in Oregon and 39 other states. Big budget cuts in Washington could hurt those in long-term care. And President Trump's niece writes a tell-all book. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 2nd, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. A dramatic trend is starting both in Oregon and across the country. KBOO's Annette Newell has the story that the latest COVID-19 numbers are telling us.
A big jump today in the number of new confirmed COVID-19 cases in Oregon. The Oregon Health Authority reported the largest ever number in a single day, 375 new positive and presumptive cases. Umatilla had the biggest surge with 88 cases, then Washington County with 67, and Multnomah County with 64. That brings the total cases in Oregon to more than 9,200. The death toll in the state stands at 209. The health authority says cases are rising faster in rural areas and in central and eastern Oregon. And coronavirus cases are rising in 40 states. The governor of Texas has issued an executive order requiring most residents in the Lone Star State to wear face masks. This is a dramatic turnaround for Governor Greg Abbott. Starting today, Texans in counties with 20 or more COVID-19 cases have to wear face masks in buildings and businesses open to the public and outdoors in public places where maintaining 6 feet of distance from others is not possible. The masks have to cover both their noses and mouths. This decision is a reversal after Abbott previously banned local governments from penalizing people who did not wear masks in public. Now they could face $250 fines. Texas was one of the first states to ease COVID-19 lockdown restrictions, but surging numbers of new cases have caused the reopening efforts there to go on hold. On Wednesday, Texas reported more than 8,000 new cases of the coronavirus. And in Florida today, they've topped that number with 10,109 new cases of COVID-19, marking a new single-day record for that state. So far, more than 3,700 Floridians have died as a result of the virus. Another number that's a sign of the surging outbreak is that the United States reported 52,789 new cases yesterday. That was the largest single-day total since the start of the pandemic. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the country's top infectious disease expert, says, quote, "I think it's pretty obvious that we are not going in the right direction." Fauci blames the rising case numbers in the U.S. at least partly to the more lenient lockdown measures than those in other countries that have managed to turn the tide on the virus. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Annette Newell.
Drug companies are getting paid big money to work on a coronavirus vaccine, but the Trump administration may not require them to sell it at a reasonable price. A consumer advocacy group called Knowledge Ecology International found that documented agreements between the Trump administration and major drug manufacturers did not limit how they can price or sell vaccines. This is unusual, since taxpayer money is being given to companies to research a COVID-19 vaccine. Typically, when public money is involved, contracts will require the eventual pharmaceutical to be made generally available to the public. The agreements make it so that the government has limited ability to intervene if drug makers charge really high prices for this crucial medicine. The contracts also limit the government in making generic versions of a name brand coronavirus treatment that could be more affordable. This revelation comes just days after Common Dreams reported that the Trump administration will allow drug manufacturer Gilead to charge upwards of $3,000 for remdesivir. That's the drug that has been found to save the lives of many COVID patients who end up on ventilators, and it too was developed with taxpayer dollars. On Wednesday, in Terry Schrunk Plaza in Portland, protesters rallied for the Palestinian Day of Rage. The rally was intended to hold space for Palestinian voices to express their pain and outrage, as well as speak to constructive action in regards to fighting Israeli colonialism. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg brings us these sounds from the rally.
In 1967, my father was a young 8-year-old boy living with his mother, his sister, in their small village in Palestine. On a fateful summer day, the Israelis invaded my father's village, and my grandmother, looking at the children in front of her, remembered what had previously happened almost 20 years before, the Nakba, the violent expulsion and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from Palestine. Looking at those children, she knew that her only choices were to have them live somewhere else safely, or potentially being dead and being ethnically cleansed and not having a future. My grandmother made the hard choice that we see many mothers making, traveling across multiple borders so their children can live a better life. My grandmother made that decision knowing that a better future, that she could get a better future for her children. It's important to know that this annexation of Palestine didn't start today, it didn't start yesterday, it didn't start in 1967, it started in 1948. It's been going on for over 70 years. Israel has been doing this since day one, and the only thing that they aren't doing anymore is lying to us about what they're doing, which is making sure that no Palestinians live on this land ever. When I
experienced yet another one of these slanderous, malicious attempts to silence Palestinian voices. It was misconstrued, tweeted, 10,000 people viewed it, it was followed, it was dangerously malicious. The tweet was taken down, it was a Coin6 reporter. I suggest y'all contact Coin6. So between the speakers, I'm going to give some of the top neoliberal myths about Israel, Palestine. So I'm going to do one, and then I'll hand off to the next speaker. One of the biggest myths is anti-Zionism is anti-Semitic. At a broad sweep, Zionism is the exceptionalist belief that defines one people above all other people on the basis of a faith and claims an uncontestable right to the establishment of a state on those terms. And as a Semite myself, with some Jewish blood that runs through my veins, having grown up exposed to Jewish values from Jewish family members, I say loudly and clearly, Judaism does not allow for the actions of Israel, justified by the logic of Zionism.
So, you know, when I see people gathered here with this day of rage, I want you to carry that same rage that you're feeling. And I feel that rage too. When I see, you know, Trump and Netanyahu, when I see them, you know, patting each other on the back and congratulating each other about what they're going to do to Palestine, and Trump being given the green light, or Trump giving the green light to Netanyahu to continue this annexation, I feel rage. Because when I look at, you know, what's happening in Palestine, I see a white supremacist state. It looks very similar to what I see and experience here. It's the same thing. And I feel it here as a Black American. I feel the same evil. And I'm enraged. When I see that, I feel rage, okay? So it's not, I'm here not for likes or acceptance. I'm here because I'm enraged. Because when I look at the history, when you look, okay, go back to South Africa. We saw apartheid. There was a police state abusing the indigenous Zulu and Xhosa tribes men. And the same thing, and when Nelson Mandela, he told us to look to Palestine to be free, because none of us are free, as we know, until we're all free. So if we're asking for our freedom, if Black Americans asking, we want freedom, we're also asking for Palestinian freedom. If Palestinians are asking for freedom, they're also asking for Black freedom. You know, our police have trained, it's been proven that police here in America have trained with the Israeli army. They're using the same tactics. So, and back to Palestine, you know, they're trying to annex Palestine. From what I understand, I'm not going to educate you on Palestine, but there's people that have done a very good job with that. But what I understand is they're trying to close the border between Palestine and Jordan. So now the Palestinian homes will be, or what it, the land will be shut off from, they'll be circled all around by Israeli settlements. You know, people are not going to have even a way to get out. They're already, there's no airport. So people are all going to be completely surrounded by a very corrupt force. And that makes me angry. And that's scary that these people have this power to do something like this. And it needs to not happen.
In 2014, during the Ferguson uprising, like Samira mentioned earlier, organizers held signs and flags to show their support for the Palestinian people. Similarly, Palestinian organizers took to the internet to support the uprising and provided protesters with tips for mitigating the impacts of tear gas and pepper spray, because tear gas cartridges deployed in Ferguson and throughout the West Bank were manufactured by the same Pennsylvania company. These connections are not conspiracy. We know that the surveillance technologies perfected by Israel against the Palestinian people are then used at the U.S.-Mexico border to surveil migrant and border communities. We make these connections to understand the way imperialism functions to reproduce death and destruction on a global scale. Like Malcolm X said, we have to organize house by house, street by street, city by city, state by state, every Black man of African descent in the Western Hemisphere. And then you and I can stop the acts of atrocity, not only in Mississippi, but also in the Congo.
Those were sounds from the Palestinian Day of Rage protest Wednesday in Terry Schrunk Plaza. 1.4 million Americans filed for unemployment last week, signaling that economic gains made in May could be short-lived. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics released its June report today, showing that the unemployment rate dropped from May to June. This coincides with the reopening process that many states began in mid-May. More concerning, though, is the surge in the share of job losses that are considered permanent. This is in contrast to earlier reports of major job loss that were temporary, as in when businesses were temporarily closed due to the coronavirus. Those who considered their unemployment temporary were waiting for the economy to reopen, expecting they could return to work. Experts say that this change shows the economic gains made in May are fragile and could go away if COVID-19 case spikes four states back into lockdown. The unemployment rate is hovering around 11%, much better than in April when it was close to 20. That said, 11% is still higher than any time during the Great Recession. It's also important to note that job gains have been higher for white Americans than for Asian and Black Americans. One bright spot was the higher rate of job gains for Latinx Americans, at a rate of 3.2%, though their overall unemployment level is still higher than that for white Americans. A bill in Congress would create $3 billion in a program for coastal restoration projects. The Oregon coast has been hit hard economically by COVID-19, and as Eric Tegedoff reports, this bill could benefit them.
Communities on the Oregon coast could see sorely needed investments from an infrastructure bill now in Congress. Gene Flemma, director of the Ocean Defense Initiative, says COVID-19 has hit the economies of coastal communities hard, with many fishing-related businesses losing their markets.
A lot of fishermen themselves have found that they are having a hard time making ends meet, making their boat payments, etc. And in addition, coastal tourism, hotels were shut down, restaurants have been shut down.
The Moving Forward Act would create a $3 billion program to invest in coastal restoration projects. Oregon Representatives Susan Bonamici and Peter DeFazio are sponsoring the bill. The House is expected to vote on the bill today. Flemma says restoration work on Oregon's coast would help restore streams, coastal wetlands, and tidal areas that are crucial for the habitats of salmon and other fish species. She says the work would have immediate benefits for the habitat itself.
The long-term benefit is the restoration of the fishery itself, which generates jobs in the long term through commercial and recreational fishing opportunities and tourism opportunities.
A National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration analysis finds 15 jobs are created for every $1 million spent on coastal restoration projects. Flemma says restoration projects would make coastal communities more climate resilient as well.
You also are reducing coastal flooding and other impacts from storm surges or high tides or sea level rise, things that are becoming more severe and more frequent as a result of climate change.
She says another benefit of restoring tidal wetlands, seagrasses, and other parts of the coast is that they are carbon sinks. That means they absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, helping to mitigate climate change. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Long-term care advocates say budget cuts in Washington state would expose the most vulnerable people. As Eric Tegedoff reports, the worst-case cuts would slash an estimated $220 million from the Medicaid long-term care services budget.
Long-term care advocates in Washington state are rallying against budget cuts they say would be disastrous for the state's most vulnerable residents. As the state grapples with COVID-19's economic fallout, agencies are being asked to consider what cuts look like. The worst-case scenario would slash $220 million from Washington's Medicaid long-term care services budget. Kathy McCall with AARP Washington says that would affect more than 20,000 older people and people with disabilities.
This is not the time to cut the long-term care budget. These are the most vulnerable of our community and also the most susceptible to the COVID virus. So we do not want to undermine the system that helps protect those individuals.
Other groups urging the state not to make these cuts include Casa Latina, Catholic Community Services, and the Home Care Workers Union SEIU 775. McCall says many people receive services in their homes, helping them with things such as getting dressed and preparing meals. She says cuts also will hurt caregivers at a time when millions of people are unemployed.
We've got to recognize that one of the largest industries is home care workers, and this could also have a devastating impact on the ability for long-term care workers to have work.
McCall understands that lawmakers...
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on racism in Portland and Minneapolis and police reform. At 6, we'll hear Rose City Native Radio, then stay tuned at 8 for Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy, down to a low of 56. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy as well, up to a high of 75. Today in history, on this date in 1964, President Lyndon Johnson signed into law the historic Civil Rights Act at the White House before a national television audience. Some groups on the West Coast are demanding higher taxes on the wealthy to address issues of budget equity. As Suzanne Potter reports, anti-poverty advocates are holding car rallies in five cities across California to protest cuts to social programs.
Groups that fight for racial and economic justice are rallying across California this week, asking for higher taxes on the wealthy instead of budget cuts that disproportionately affect lower-income families. Without a major infusion of state or federal dollars, the state budget will cut tens of billions from schools, healthcare, and other important community services. Melissa Romero with the California League for Conservation Voters says corporations and high earners should contribute more.
We can actually move forward in a way that gives people clean air, clean water, affordable housing, living wage jobs, quality health care, quality education. It shouldn't be either or. There needs to be another way.
The week of action for the Commit to Equity campaign began with a car rally at the state capitol on Monday, where organizers asked for greater investment in vulnerable communities of color. On Tuesday, organizers held a similar car party protest in San Francisco and in Fresno. Tomorrow, the campaign moves to San Diego and Los Angeles. A new study from three groups, Americans for Tax Fairness, Healthcare for America Now, and Health Access California, shows that in the first 3 months of the pandemic, the wealth held by 154 billionaires in the state jumped by 25%. Meanwhile, Romero notes that essential workers like nurses, bus drivers, daycare teachers, and grocery store clerks are bearing the brunt of the economic crisis.
We see it everywhere we go. People are thanking and celebrating essential workers who are risking their lives every day, who are disproportionately holding up our economy. We need to show up for them.
More than a dozen nonprofits are sponsoring the campaign, representing labor, health, environment, social, and racial justice groups. Find out more at committoequity.org. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A major plan for the Columbia River Basin would have a big impact on Native communities in the West. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
A bill introduced in Congress aims to improve water access and quality for tribes. KLCC's Brian Bull has more.
The Western Tribal Water Infrastructure Act would authorize the EPA to fund 10 water improvement projects per year for tribes in the Columbia River Basin and adjacent basins. It also increased annual funding for the Indian Reservation Drinking Water Program from $20 million to $30 million a year. Rob Green is an attorney with the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde.
Reservations are in rural areas. A lot of the water systems are not in good shape. And there hasn't been the kind of investment that there should have been in making sure that people have safe drinking water, that there's water for fire support. The Indian Health Service said that Native people are 9 times more likely to lack access to safe water than the rest of the population.
The Senate Committee on Indian Affairs has recently held a hearing on the legislation. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Indian Health Service director was questioned by the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs Wednesday about substandard personal protective equipment purchased by the federal agency and distributed to hospitals in New Mexico and Arizona. KN95 masks, which did not meet federal standards, were sold to the IHS for $3 million from a company by Zach Fuentes, a former Trump administration staff member. New Mexico Senator Tom Udall told the IHS director Rear Admiral Michael Wiocki he's deeply troubled about the masks supplied to the Navajo Nation amid COVID-19. Wiocki told the committee the masks are in storage and the situation is procurement sensitive as they work with attorneys and the vendor on resolving the matter.
We used federal acquisition regulation requirements and the flexibilities that have been provided to us by the CARES Act. We identified and looked at 7 different vendors for that particular procurement. He had the best pricing and the delivery options available at the time. But since you've identified the needs that persist, and they do, we do need masks, and not only in Navajo, but throughout the country, we are looking at other vendors to help meet that need.
Udall says he still expects a thorough response from the IHS, which he says lawmakers have been seeking answers from since May. Wiaki was a witness at a hearing on the response to COVID-19 in Native communities. An anti-Trump rally is planned Friday in the tourist town of Keystone, South Dakota, as President Trump is scheduled to attend a celebration at Mount Rushmore. Native organizers plan to protest the arrival of Trump, saying the visit is on stolen sacred land. Tribal leaders in South Dakota are among those who say Mount Rushmore represents genocide. Cheyenne River Sioux Chairman Harold Frazier says to Lakota people, Mount Rushmore represents the faces of men who lied, cheated, and murdered innocent people whose only crime was living on the land they wanted to steal. In his daily community radio address Wednesday on KIPI, Frazier said he's not personally sending people to the protest, but commented on the importance of the area.
The Black Hills are sacred to our people and through our creation stories. They determine and tell us why they're sacred. And you know, it is a place where a lot of our people have gone throughout time to, find their answers and make their prayers. So, you know, anything different is a desecration to it.
Renewed calls have been raised over the removal of presidents carved into the Black Hills amid racial justice rallies across the country, which have included the toppling of statues and monuments of colonizers. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Pressure is mounting to expand Medicaid during the coronavirus emergency. Wyoming's decision to not expand Medicaid coverage has cost that state alone almost $1 billion in federal tax dollars since 2013. Eric Galatis has more on that story.
As more Wyoming workers lose their job-related health insurance because of downturns in coal, oil, and gas during the COVID-19 health emergency, lawmakers are reconsidering the option of expanding Medicaid health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Jen Simon with the Equality State Policy Center says this perfect storm has put residents in states such as Wyoming that have not yet expanded coverage at greater risk than neighboring states.
40% of the population in non-expansion states will become uninsured. For states that have expanded the Medicaid health insurance program, far fewer people will lose health insurance coverage.
Simon points to polls showing that a majority of Wyomingites support expanding Medicaid to cover more residents. Opponents of expansion have argued that Wyoming doesn't need help from the federal government to take care of its residents and warned that the state could be on the hook for additional costs if the Affordable Care Act implodes. Simon notes that Wyoming would not be on the hook because the state could reverse expansion if the federal contribution to Medicaid fell below 90%. She adds that during the economic downturn, leaving hundreds of millions of dollars on the table as the state faces budget shortfalls is fiscally irresponsible and goes against the state's values of taking care of its own.
To turn down hundreds of millions of dollars that Wyoming citizens have already paid in federal income tax that would be returned to our state to help our friends and neighbors and provide health insurance coverage.
Simon says loss of health coverage can be devastating for individuals and families and entire economies, especially in rural parts of the state where hospitals, which are economic engines and primary employers, face the prospects of bankruptcy. Hospitals and other care facilities are expected to see a spike in uncompensated care as people without coverage can't pay their bills. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
A tell-all book written by President Trump's niece may end up making it into readers' hands, despite an earlier restraining order against its publication. The book is called Too Much and Never Enough: How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man by Mary L. Trump. Earlier this week, a court issued a restraining order to prevent the book from being published on July 28th. Mary's relatives claimed the book violated a 20-year-old confidentiality agreement that Mary signed after a struggle over her grandfather's will. An appellate court reversed that restraining order, saying that while Mary's confidentiality agreement is up for debate, the publisher, Simon & Schuster, did not enter into that agreement. The merits of the case still have to be decided, but now the publisher can move forward with printing books and getting them to booksellers. The court also noted that confidentiality agreements are not always enforceable by law. Instead, the punishment for breaking them is most often monetary. Opponents of President Trump celebrate the news of the impending book, as it is heard to be a scathing review of the president. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 2nd, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Janka Soderberg, Althea Billings, and Annette Newell. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Suzanne Potter, Eric Galatis, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I am joined today by local hip-hop artist Mike Crenshaw, and Mike has also been a longtime activist here in Portland and originally out of Minneapolis. So, of course, the recent events are probably making some connections for you there, Mike. I know one of the early protests, people were saying, you know, Portland is a lot like Minneapolis as far as demographics, as far as history of police violence and racism. And I wonder if you can talk about your experience with both of those cities and what's happening right now with the protests.
Yeah, this has been really visceral for me, because when I woke up on the morning of the 26th of May, I think it was, where the first thing I watched was the video on my phone of George Floyd. And it was a long enough video to where I didn't realize he was going to die, even though it was horrible, the abuse and the violence that they subjected him to. I still was like, well, at some point they're going to get off of him. I mean, why not? And I watched that video, and beyond the murder that I witnessed, the lynching and the brutality, was this recollection of what 38th in Chicago feels like at this time of year, because I've spent a lot of time in that neighborhood, and I know what the heat and the humidity, little pieces of gum stuck to the sidewalk and all that stuff feels like right there. And immediately, like, I felt a deep sense of empathy for not only George Floyd, but for what I sensed the city was going through. And then I was pleasantly surprised with the swiftness with which the uprising took hold, because I thought, you know, this can't stand. And so I was proud. I'm proud of Minneapolis. You know, people want to talk about nuances regarding provocateurs and opportunists and all that. That's part of the narrative, but I never lose sight of the central part of the narrative, the most important part of the narrative, which is that Black and Brown people in that community stood up and said enough is enough, as they should have. And that's what sparked a global rebellion. Growing up there, you know, I've spent the first part of my childhood in Chicago, in Illinois, a couple other communities in Illinois, and then I wound up moving up to St. Paul, and then ultimately landed in Minneapolis to go to high school. And so I was there in my teenage years, and those were the years at which, as an adolescent, I was out on the street having encounters with police. And there's a few, you know, I have some pretty traumatic stories. One is I went to a party with some friends, and we got jumped by these white guys, these racists, at this party. And we had to there were about six of us and about 40 of them. We had to fight our way out, and one of them hit me with a bat, and I was able to get the bat from him. And at that point, I was defending all of us with the bat. And as this was transpiring, the police came up the alley, a series of cruisers with their lights off. And I ran down the alley away from them, and as soon as I got around the corner of the garage, there were maybe five or six police with their guns and flashlights on me, and they proceeded to beat me pretty viciously. They handcuffed me, and they would lift me up off the ground. I immediately went on the ground on my stomach and put my hands behind my head because I knew that was a position to assume to get them to understand that I was compliant. But they handcuffed me, and they lift me up just to where I thought I could get my footing, and then they'd slam me back down on the ground. They did this over and over again as they beat me with flashlights and billy clubs. And so a crowd had gathered, and they were calling me nigger and, you know, swearing at me. And I remember thinking, I don't know if I'm going to make it home. That's just one occasion. I learned to fear the police, not in an irrational way, but in a practical way. I learned that they didn't care for my life, they didn't respect my life, and they might well end my life if I continued to have encounters with them. Now in Portland, not where I moved out here to when I was 22, I've mostly just been pulled over. I haven't actually been violently assaulted, but I've often been pulled over because I fit a description, so to speak. You know, they just want to harass a black man. I've often been pulled over just for making eye contact with them and holding my space. And so those are my experiences, and I know that these are common experiences for so many of us black folks. And I have a lot of faith in the resilience of our people and the ever-evolving political consciousness of our people in light of what has been made apparent by this recent series of police murders. And it's just crazy because it hasn't stopped. They're still killing people, you know. And then in light of this, we're starting to see many other murders come, you know, into the public sphere, as far as our awareness, that we, people all over the country, haven't even been aware of. And you get to see these things, you know. These cops will say shit like, say things like, excuse me with the language, they'll say things like, you know, that's not in our training. But when you see multiple police departments doing the exact same maneuvers, where they're putting a knee on the neck and they have other people restraining somebody's limb, if you're not trying to kill somebody or maim somebody, what exactly are you trying to do?
Yeah. I mean, when you just described that, it's so visceral. Like, you could have been George Floyd.
Yeah. I remember in my body wanted to fight and defend myself because I was fleeing for survival from a racist attack. And I fled into the, you know, out of the frying pan into the fire, right? So now these police are going to kill me. And I remember thinking, knowing I had a right to survive the encounter that I just experienced, knowing I was in the right to defend myself, but now my life is being threatened, and the pain and the trauma of the moment and me going, my body telling me to fight back, you know, and me having to do this crazy, like, psychic override to, like, force myself to not defend myself. And to still, not, like, to know that, like, if I actually defend myself now, death is certain. And that if I just lay here and take it, so to speak, I might survive. And I remember thinking that if I defend myself, they're going to kill me. And they might kill me if I don't defend myself. And what are their, what's my mom going to hear? They're going to tell my mother that I had drugs on me or that I had a gun on me or something. So I know, I feel like I know what George was going through and what so many of us go through. And that's something that is unbelievable to so many people, but it's so common and understood by those of us who've experienced it.
Yeah. Wow. So now we have this movement, this uprising. And, you know, I heard you a week ago or so talking to David Rovics and saying that you feel like your whole life's work of music has been leading up to this moment. And I wonder if you can talk about that and the music that you make and what it means for us right now as this movement develops.
You know, my music is a reflection of the fighting spirit and the will to survive, and the both the objective and subjective, like forced political consciousness. When I say forced, I mean like I didn't choose the oppressive experiences that are part of being black in this society, but that they've been something that I've been forced to experience just as a matter of survival and existence. My response is what I have chosen, and my response is to respond with an intentional political consciousness and analysis of why. I'm asking why, and I'm trying to answer why we have to go through this. What does it come from, and what are the roots, and what are the reasons, and why does it still persist? And that process of asking those questions is what has politicized me. And so the art is a reflection of just experiencing these things and trying to grapple with it and answer the questions. So I'm going to look at history. I'm going to look at the intersections between what all of us experience and the disparity between what some of us experience and some of us don't, and understand that the origins of these things are not accidental. They don't exist in a vacuum. They're part of a continuum that's been created intentionally by those who seek to control and dominate for their benefit at the expense of us all. And that's the truth. And it's not something that you learn about in school unless you have a radical educator, you know. And now that the pandemic has given people the, you know, the forced or circumstantial opportunity to slow down and look and examine how central capitalism has been to our lives, to the point where our jobs have taken most of our time and energy, to the point where we don't have time to take care of ourselves or to be with our loved ones, and the ways in which we interact with the environment and with technology is causing a global ecological catastrophe that is irreversible in some respects. All these things are connected. And so I feel a sense of urgency because I want to be able to contribute something that makes things better with my time and energy. And we don't know. And it's crazy because we just don't know. We have to try, and we have to be determined, and we have to try to craft some certainty around our commitments. But we still are working against forces that have been fueled by consolidation of resources and wealth over centuries and centuries, you know? And we only get so much time to live. And so, I don't know. That's what my orientation is. It's like, how do I do the best work that I can do while I'm here? And art and music gives me a way, I think, to engage and still find some joy and love.
You know, this movement started after the murder of George Floyd and, of course, Breonna Taylor. And people quickly went to abolish the police, but that's now changed to defund the police. And here in Portland, the biggest push that was made was for a cut to the Portland police by what amounts to about 7% of their budget from last year. And it seems like some people are maybe satisfied with that. And I wonder if you could talk about what you see as the difference between abolition and reform and which way we should be pushing.
You know, we always want to push for our wildest dream, the best case scenario, the highest possible potential outcome. So if you were to ask me, here's a metaphor, you want to do with your life, I love travel. So, you know, now things are changing. We don't know how accessible travel is going to be for people who aren't extremely privileged, right? But as a dreamer and as a younger person, I'd be like, I want to travel. And so in my mind, if I thought, well, what would be the ultimate, you know, manifestation of my wildest desires as far as travel? I want to see every country in every region, you know, in every ecosystem, in every climate, in every geographical location. I want to see all of it and experience all of it. So let's take that kind of vision I might have for myself and my wildest dreams, and let's impose that on this whole question of reform versus revolution, because abolition would be something that would be part of a revolutionary change and shift in civilization and society. That would be the highest aspirational goal. Let's get rid of the toxic, deadly, predatory, oppressive forces in our communities that threaten our very existence on a day-to-day basis, especially in poor working class communities, Black communities, communities of color, indigenous communities, Latinx communities, people who are marginalized for their mental health status, their economic status, their sexual orientation, their gender, you know, whatever it is, the ways that the police are interacting are to serve and protect the interests of the wealthy and the elite. And our lives are just fodder. We're collateral damage. So I want to get rid of that at the highest end of what my desires would be. Now, the reality of it is that a revolutionary change that would abolish not only the police, but all the violent systems of extraction and oppression that of which the police are one, is what I would hope humanity could achieve at some point. What we know is the reform, I think, is a concession-based set of activities and intentions and projects that have to do with this these ideas about incremental change and trying to hold on to as much of the status quo as one can and just change and tweak little bits and pieces of it to make it feel less threatening. And I think that the reason that happens is because many of us for a multi-generational timeline, you know, chronologically speaking, we don't have a memory of anything but what we've experienced in this society. So we don't know what it feels like to not have the police. And we've been indoctrinated with so much propaganda and social conditioning that we've been trained to believe that the police are our necessity. And we can't recollect the time when the police didn't exist and where people had other ways of organizing to defend their communities and to hold people accountable as far as things that were threats to our lives and our safety. So what we need to do is envision something different and do the work of organizing so that once these systems are transformed and these police are not in our communities, that we have actually set into place measures and ways of organizing to protect and take care of ourselves. And that is going to take time, and I think a lot of people are not ready for that. They think that abolition is too radical of an idea, and it scares people who just haven't been spending time visualizing and imagining a different world, you know. And I think it's easier for people to this is funny, I say this quote so much, and I don't know who initially said it. I think I heard it from my comrade Sherry Huntley at one point. She might have got it from Reverend Barber, I don't know, but that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And so I say capitalism because it's this relation that private property and wealth has to the masses that mandates the police forces and the military forces to be used to control the population. And the violence is their tool. Violence and repression is their tool. And to me, it's heinous. And to me, I know, like, yeah, there are people out here who are doing bad things to other people, but I do believe that if we could remove the central underlying core problematic entities, then people would learn in that process how to be better human beings towards each other, because we wouldn't be so aligned with this sickness that uses violence as its only means of operation. So that there's going to be people in my community who look like me, who are friends and comrades, who are going to settle for reform because it feels like progress to them. And it's not my job to discredit them or disrespect them, say bad things about them publicly. You know, it's my job to say, okay, if that's all you can put your energy towards right now, then go ahead and do that. But the rest of us who are pushing towards something more revolutionary are going to continue pushing for that. And I hope that at some point in time that our efforts can coordinate and there can be more alignment and solidarity, because ultimately it just makes logical sense that if there's a violent threat in our community to our lives, that we would want to figure out ways to remove that. And right now, I see that as the police.
The violent threat to our community.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It's clear as day. Yeah, there are people out here because of capitalism, because of poverty, because of economic hardship. There are people out here who are stealing things from each other. There are people out here who are hurting each other because they've been forced to be in competition with each other and view each other as threats. But that's because of capitalism. That's the root cause of that, to me. Some people will say, well, no, humans are just conditioned to be that way. They're always going to be sociopaths, and they're always going to be predator and prey and so on and so forth. And I'm like, okay, that's part of the human condition, but that part of the human condition is reinforced by other relationships that are dominant in society. And if you remove those things that are forced upon us that cause the dysfunction, then there's an opportunity for us to behave differently.
And you see that dysfunction as the removal of capitalism. And I wonder, you know, bell hooks talks about the three prongs: the white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy. Do you see all of those as connected as well?
Yeah, I mean they are. They're those are the tools that created the modern civilization. The capitalism is about the consolidation of wealth and resources for the interest of the profiteers and the owners and the rulers and the elite, the top percentile, the most wealthy are the ones who are going to control the army that invades to secure the resources that are extracted, the army that kills the people to separate the people from the land where the resources are being extracted from, and the political system that is ruled by male patriarchal interests to control the earth and impose social controls and codes and behavior on the populace for the purpose of keeping the extracted wealth flowing towards reinforcing their power that is maintained through violence. So to me, that's what capitalism, white supremacy and patriarchy looks like. And we know that there are other regions of the world where people that aren't of Western European descent, but they still participate in these systems. So one could argue that there's a human element to the way we've organized under the dominant systems of oppression that transcends whiteness. But I'll say that in modern history, it's been the consolidation and creation of whiteness as a political, economic, and military force that has had taken ideological root in identities of people for different reasons throughout history, that it became more advantageous for whiteness to operate as an organized force of oppression against other people to protect the interests of a small group of white people, but that in creating a kind of buffer class of white people who had certain privileges that were excluded, that other people were excluded from accessing, you created almost an army of people who are going to fight to protect their entitlement that's attached to their white identity. And that's what, when we see the term Make America Great Again, and we see this kind of nationalistic, patriarchal identity, that's actually a political force and a violent force. That's what the USA is. We see this across Europe as well. So you can't have one without the other. And it's an easy connection for me, but I can understand where it seems like a bit of a stretch for some people, because we haven't been taught to analyze things in a radical way and look at the different root causes as part of the same thing. And we've been taught, many of us in this society, we've been taught that the privileges that we do have here that are actually the byproduct of this extraction and oppression, we've been taught to think that those are the best lives, that the things that we have access to here as consumers have given us a standard of living that's the best on earth. And so we become so dependent and reliant on these things that we become afraid to lose them, and we've been taught to think the whole time that nobody has it as good as us, and that if we don't follow the rules, then we'll wind up being like those people who are starving in a third world country and who are experiencing terrorism, when the reality is there are other ways to live that aren't less sick. But the problem is that the police still exist. And one, something that not many people are talking about, especially in media, although some of us are having these conversations in private, is what happens when we see the retaliation of the police, that their response to the uprising has been escalated violence and repression. They're going after activists, they're targeting activists in different areas. And so what we see and we have to be aware of is that the police as an organized culture and force is going to respond to the threat of the abolishment of their livelihoods with, they're going to pivot, and they're going to be, some of them are going to be on some organized vigilante stuff, you know, and that's something we have to contend with, and it's scary and it sucks, but it's a problem that we're going to have to face. That I anticipate further retaliation and escalation of force as that arm of white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, protection of private property, putting the value of property over the lives of people, that is under threat, because the people know that we're tired of that being a threatening force against our lives. So in uprising and in rebellion, we're going to emerge with the desire to abolish that, the most radical among us. And we're going to have to organize. And in once, as we start to organize and move in that direction, they're going to respond.
And on that note, I think we're going to leave it. Thank you so much, Mike Crenshaw, for joining us today on KBOO.
Thank you, Jenka.
This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO Radio. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.